So good morning. I'm Janet Zimmerman, and my role in the pilot is to provide support to the pilot through evaluation. So I'm going to talk this morning about, first let me say I have no relationships to disclose, about what that means. What approach are we taking to evaluate what Terry has described and what you've heard from Mr. McGee and Mr. Allen. I'm also going to talk about the kinds of evaluation questions that the evaluation is interested in gathering information on. What is it that we hope to learn from the pilot that evaluation can support in investigating? We'll talk a bit about the methods for evaluation and also some of the high-level emerging themes, what it is we're learning from the assessment that you've heard about at a high level. We're in the very early stages to the Herculean efforts of Daryl and Chris Cox, who is seated right here as the site coordinator. They succeeded in just recently completing the assessments for both the middle school and the high school, and that was a major undertaking. So hats off to them for their persistence and their success in gathering this information. So we literally right now are just beginning to analyze it. So we're keeping things at the high level. We don't yet have specific findings to share. So I wanted to start out by talking about the approach we're taking to evaluation. Foremost, it's utilization focused. And by that I mean that beyond accountability, beyond letting funders know that in fact what has been expected of them has been achieved, this really is about gathering information, this is my charge, that's useful to them. So the questions that they have, that they want answers to as part of the administration, the implementation of evaluation of the pilot, I then am faced with the challenge of how do I gather this information so that in fact evaluation is dynamic, used in real time. It serves as a companion to strategic planning. It's not an add-on at the end of the pilot. It's used to make mid-course corrections, to inform about ongoing impact, progress from multiple perspectives. So throughout, our emphasis is on practicality, utility, and the value of what I'm doing rather than simply writing a report that goes on the shelf after the funder receives it. It's also participatory throughout. It's very difficult to understand how one can complete an evaluation without having mixed methods, quantitative, qualitative, but also through having the input from those who have a stake in the results. By definition, the way in which we're proceeding with this through a local project team that's been established, through other sources, is to hear from students, is to hear from Mr. McGee, is to hear from the staff of the school-based health center, to hear from some of the key partner organizations that are involved in the pilot, to hear from the perspectives of the folks at the center, to hear from parents to the extent that they are included as representatives in this diverse local project team that has been convened to guide and advise on planning, but also I intend absolutely to engage them in the evaluation and get their perspectives on opportunities for improvement, their perspectives on where there's an impact, where there are challenges, and what they think strategies are for managing some of those challenges. Evaluation in the context of the pilot is also contextual. We recognize that beyond the school-based health center, there are other forces clearly in students' lives that affect the kinds of outcomes that the pilot's hoping to achieve. So the work that we will do in evaluation is grounded in this larger context. What is going on at the school? What's going on in their homes? What's going on in the neighborhoods? What other programs are they participating in beyond the programs and the approach provided by the pilot? Evaluation needs to know about that in order to sort of tease apart what role the pilot in particular is playing in helping to achieve some of the outcomes intended. So what are the guiding evaluation questions? What kinds of things at the high level are we interested in learning about the pilot? First and sort of foremost is impact. What difference is it making in the lives of students and creating conditions that are favorable to reducing the likelihood of dropout, to increasing the likelihood of graduation? And so I've handed out a copy of So the question that I have is, what difference are we making? And then you'll see that there is a handout over on the side. If you don't have it, there are additional ones of what we're calling the outcomes diagram. And what this is the answer to that, the sorts of things that we're going to be looking at to answer that question. This, it looks like a logic model. It isn't. We haven't identified the strategies or linked, except with the exception of a few examples at the bottom, linked them with the kinds of outcomes. This simply is a map of the so what. What is it that this work is intended to intended to achieve? What kinds of impact is this work designed to produce? So you'll see at the left-hand side of the diagram are shorter-term kinds of outcomes, and they include students' needs and risk profiles have been assessed school-wide. Students throughout the school are participating in the prevention and intervention strategies. Greater proportions of the student body are enrolled in and utilizing the school-based health center services. Students are more knowledgeable of how to manage the stressors they face in their lives productively. Students have a greater sense of connection with the school-based health center and the school as a result of expanded roles the school-based health centers are playing. The school-based health center is playing in supporting students' needs. There are others identified as well, but those are examples of sort of the nearer-term kinds of outcomes that the pilot intends to achieve, and that could be of great interest in the evaluation as we move forward and seeing the extent to which those kinds of outcomes have been produced. You'll see that there is a shaded area. One of the purposes, anything to do with Terry Wright, is action-oriented. We don't stop with just building readiness. We're holding ourselves accountable for producing change, for producing the kinds of outcomes you see in the shaded area. So improvements in student behavior, they're actually engaging in fewer risk behaviors as a result of the expanded role that the school-based health center is playing school-wide. More engaging and more health-promoting behaviors. There are school-wide improvements in academic and in their academic performance. They're more likely to attend school if they're healthy and better positioned to manage the stressors that they face that may have served as barriers, for example. Lower rates of tardiness and truancy. So crossing the line from just simply looking at health outcomes to looking at their impact on educational success, which is fundamental, as Terry's described, to the purpose of this work. How do we relate the two to reduce, how do we provide this expanded role for the school-based health center to have an impact on the likelihood of dropping out or staying in school? So we're interested in that in terms of evaluation, of looking at what has this pilot contributed to improvements. Hard to do that with the kind of statistics that Mr. McGee just reported at 89% graduation. Hats off to you. But those are some of the questions that we're interested in, is how can the school-based health center support the school in your continued work to build on that and to have other successes and improvements in measurements of academic outcomes. Interested in a greater sense of connectedness in school as the relationships are established school-wide with the school-based health center staff. For example, is there in fact an increased likelihood of feeling connected, that they have adults who care about them, they have a team that's available to them? Is that a change that accompanies the work of the pilot? It certainly is an intention of it. And that more students believe that the school is providing this healthy, safe environment that is attractive to them. And this clearly is in concert with what the school is already doing, with what some of the other resources that you're bringing into the school are contributing to. But what role does the school-based health center play in achieving these kinds of outcomes? And then we look, as we go further to the right, improvements in students' health. Are they feeling, through their self-perceptions, improvements in their own appraisal of health status, whether it's social, emotional health, or even physical health through increased opportunities, as Terry was describing, the question about electricity. Are they facing impediments to using, to managing, controlling their asthma because of their inability to use the tools that they have available? If you don't have electricity, it makes it hard to do that. So in addition, you know, ultimately what this is all about is reducing the likelihood of dropout and increasing graduation. At the bottom, you'll see we're also interested, the pilot's interested, and evaluation is here to support what the pilot is interested in, the kinds of changes, school-based health center level changes. And you'll see some examples of what we mean by that. For example, that there's an expansion in school-based health centers' partnerships with community resources, as Mr. McGee identified and as Daryl was talking about as well, that the school-based health center is building relationships with this expertise, with these resources that are coming in, and there's this expanded network of partnership and opportunity, therefore, to channel students as needed school-wide and in the pullout at the more individual or smaller group level to take advantage of these resources that are being developed. So that is an outcome of interest. Is the school-based health center, in fact, at the heart of this, part of the engine of capitalizing on building these relationships? We're also interested in looking at school-level outcomes. What difference is the pilot making in building relationships between and helping to develop these relationships with the school-based health center and the school? At the school level, are the partnerships with the school-based health center to support the integration of public health into the school culture and health education curriculum? Is that happening? To what degree? Where are there opportunities for greater impact on school-level outcomes? Through one of the tools that Chris has been using, the CDC's, the site coordinator, school health index, he is convening or plans to convene teams of representative stakeholders to look at opportunities, first to assess and look at opportunities for 5 minutes for building on school-wide, in concert with the school, ways of having an impact through the school-based health center. So beyond questions about outcome, we're also interested in looking at implementation, providing meaning to the kinds of outcomes observed. So implementation and lessons learned. What are the key strengths and challenges of implementation? How effectively have they been managed? What's being learned along the way about which strategies are working well, which are not, and the reasons? To what extent is the work aligning with the guiding model? We want to make sure that what we're evaluating, in fact, is the model as designed by the center and not some iteration of it or modified version of it, so that what we're finding, in fact, links back to the model as intended. And if it doesn't, that is an opportunity for correction, for conversation about how do we really actualize and operationalize this model in the way in which it is intended to go beyond the clinic. What opportunities exist for improvement? There also is a big interest in sharing and disseminating what's learned from this pilot so that others can benefit. How do we bring work like this to scale nationally? How can it be relevant in other local contexts? And also, what does it take for work like this to succeed and grow? The methods, very quickly, we're taking a case study approach, which means we're gathering information, comprehensive information along the way. We're also using mixed methods, qualitative and quantitative. Key fundamental to the evaluation is obtaining the stakeholders' perspectives, whether through the local project team or through individual interviews or discussion groups. That's fundamental, that we're hearing from diverse perspectives along the way. Assessment of risk factors, you've heard a bit about RAPS and YRBSS, used to provide sort of the baseline understanding of what are the needs, what are the kinds of risk behaviors and risk factors and stressors these students are facing. I mentioned the school health index that looks at school health and safety policies and evaluation, sort of standard things of workshops, document and record review. I want to be sure to allow time to talk about some of these high-level emerging themes. Which, of course, is what this work is about in the first place, to identify some of the needs that are emerging from the RAPS Public Health Survey, to some degree to what this will be the RAPS Public Health that I'm presenting, but supported as well by some of the other sources, such as YRBSS, is consistent with some of these findings. And when I say YRBSS, that is conducted in the school. So these are data supplementary to the RAPS Public Health. So emotional factors. So as Daryl mentioned, this, in fact, rises to the top. One of the 10 most frequent responses experienced by both middle school and high school students was often feeling sad or down, as though they had nothing to look forward to. We haven't conducted tests of significance yet for RAPS public health findings, but there are substantial gaps in responses by gender, with girls reporting more often than boys. In fact, of all of the top five groups who provided this risk response, all of them were girls in grades 7 through 12. Being sexually active but not always using protection. Engaging in sexual activity is relatively common among high school students, substantially more so than among middle school students, thankfully. the exception to this is eighth grade boys, who report that they're active at levels somewhat equal to their high school counterparts. Among those who were sexually active, girls were somewhat more likely to report that they don't always use protection than boys, however. This was true in both middle school and in high school, although the numbers of girls who indicated that they were sexually active in middle school was quite small. Leslie, did you say my time has expired?
Yeah.
Would you like me to quickly continue with this, or shall we, what is your preference?
Quickly.
Okay. All right. So carried a weapon to protect themselves. This was among the top five risk responses for high school students and the top 10 for middle school. More boys than girls provided this risk response in middle school. In high school, this was slightly reversed, with 9th and 10th graders, girls, being somewhat more likely than their male counterparts to report that they carried a weapon. When they're angry, they do things that get them in trouble. This was the number one response for middle school students and among the top 10 for high school students. It was similarly, roughly similarly true with boys and girls. Were threatened, teased, or hurt by someone who made them feel sad, unsafe, and afraid. This was among the top five risk responses reported by middle school girls. It persisted as an issue at the high school level, but for smaller proportions of students and for boys and girls similarly. That they missed school because they had to take care of someone, work, or had problems getting to school. This was common among all students. It represented the second most frequent frequent response for middle school students and for high school students alike. Both boys and girls experienced it in roughly similar proportions. In middle school, boys were more often than girls to report that they missed school because of symptoms of asthma. In high school, the gender effect was reversed. And this is the closing slide. So these and the assortment of other factors being identified point to the importance of developing strategies that are comprehensive and integrated, strategies that work in tandem in a seamless, cohesive way, and that are tailored. They recognize and respond to variations in risk profile by gender, age, other factors, programming that provides a global strategy. Even these few data we've looked at so far make it clear that programming that provides a global strategy without tailored interventions is likely to miss the mark on particular needs of groups of students. These findings also suggest that, as does common wisdom, that these risk factors do not often occur in isolation. They tend to be multiple and interconnected. Another analysis, for example, showed that 4 out of 10 middle school students and 6 out of 10 high school students reported 6 or more risk factors. That's out of a total of 30 possible questions. Analyses of the kinds of risk factors that tend to be clustered together are forthcoming. And in closing, I would suggest that evaluation plays a pivotal role in supporting school-based health centers and schools' need for information. Information that's critical in formulating well-informed strategies for broadening school-based health centers' reach and impact on students school-wide and beyond. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please join me once again in giving the entire panel a round of applause. And I don't see a microphone out there, so I'm going to assume you don't need to have one. And therefore, we're ready to take questions. We can start anywhere. Yes? If it's for a particular person or general?
Both for Mr. Allen and Principal McGee.
Okay.
I participated in some research interviewing women who are trans and have been pregnant. It was looking at social determinants affecting drop out, do whatever, and be supported.
Okay.
So I was curious if you were doing anything to possibly maybe consider providing prenatal care in the school clinic, or making sure that the kids are getting it so they're healthy pregnancies, but still staying in the school.
From an educational standpoint,
I think you might have to come
back to comfort and what we have out of that.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. McGee, would you come over? Yeah, because I'm not sure that you're being projected all the way back. Sorry. Unfortunately, there's not a mic at the table, so I apologize for that.
We've taken a multilinear approach for the young ladies who have become pregnant. They can speak with the representatives in St. John's in terms of the testing and also the prenatal care. But in addition, from an educational standpoint, those students who have to physically leave school, that they have online coursework that they can take, simulcast classes that they can take to keep up with their course load. In addition to that, we're opening up an early childhood program in January for 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds for our students so that their children can come to school and they'll be in a safe environment and they'll continue their education. Yeah.
Daryl, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Part of the mental health clinician, one of the things that I've done in working with some of the ladies who tested positive for pregnancy, I've provided them with parenting classes, referrals for parenting classes in their communities. A lot of our services are confidential services, and it's up to the kids to decide whether or not or when to inform their parents about their pregnancies. So what we do, we also sit down, we counsel the kids, about informing their parents about pregnancies and some of the consequences that may come as a result. Work with young ladies whose parents have thrown them out as a result of their pregnancies, and I've had to link services in the community to find them shelters just to reside in.
Yes, ma'am? Right here, and then I'll come on that side. Okay.
So I'm taught in the school in Georgia, and now I'm in the public health arena. And from what I can tell, there's this pocket of just strong leaders making great things happen, and I think you all showed that. And so my question is, how do we replicate the strong leaders? How do we build strong leaders advocating from the education standpoint and the health standpoint to close these inextricable links?
Yeah. We clone them. We clone them.
I think literally that you have to continue to advocate for organizations such as this, the American
Public
Association, number one. Number two, literally that. Students graduate, but tradition doesn't. So the tradition is turned into policy and procedure that formulates continuous thought, actions, and deeds.
So I'd just like to add to that as well. I think for those of us who are the champions and the advocates, creating those partnerships, creating the awareness, doing the advocacy, and connecting the dots. So, for example, Mr. McGee belongs to different principal associations and organizations, whether it be in Michigan or nationally. So now we know the pearl that he is. How can he infect other principals so that they become advocates around this? How? What are the platforms, the strategic platforms for Mr. McGee or Mr. Allen or Mr. Cox to speak at and engage with in order to spread that understanding? I think that's the only way it's going to happen, and that we break outside of our silos so that we're not just in the health world, but that we're crossing the bridge into the education community and espousing this. And we've done that deliberately. So we meet at the National Assembly of School-Based Healthcare, now School-Based Health Alliance. We've been at their meetings presenting for the last several years. And when I ran the initiative around school-based healthcare policy program, the bridge was just even creating sensitivity and awareness about the role of the education community, because it was just sort of, we were doing the same thing. Okay, we all operate in our comfort zone and with our own language. So how do you go across the bridge into someone else's community with a different language, different mores, different tradition, different priorities, and convince them to adopt your priorities? And we just have to keep chipping away at it. And we've made significant progress. I think the fact that we have an education objective in a health policy document is major. It's never happened before. So we're making progress. We can't stop. And we have to cultivate others to get on this movement and do it as well. Because when they think about it, it's two sides of the same coin, health and education, and it makes sense to do it. So, were you at the session yesterday? Oh, okay. One of the gentlemen there from the education community wants us to come to their annual meeting and present, the Coalition on Schools Educating Boys of Color would like us to do the same thing there. America's Promise Alliance, which is focused on dropout prevention, we're working with them to do the same thing there. So we just got to keep chipping at it. Yeah.
The question of how can this be used is one of the guiding questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the evaluation report ought to be useful in that regard, in really describing the approach of the center, how it meshes with what we're hearing from the school side and the school-based health center side.
So I'm going to start, I'm going to go to the other side, and then I'll come back here. But the lady in the brown sweater has had her hand up for a little while. I'll get to everybody.
So
yes, ma'am.
I'd like to just speak to that as well. I live in Georgia as well. And all the high-level attempts that we take to chip away at this in terms of speaking at conferences, one of the things that I started doing last year was going speaking at seminars in our College of Education and talking about health disparities. And in particular,
perfect example.
I spoke to a seminar group of special education teachers. And I used the Unnatural Causes series to spur conversation. And it just opened up those educators' eyes in ways they had never, ever thought about health and impacting their students. And moving them out of their own silo of thinking strictly about special education without thinking about the contextual issues in which their students are living.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, all the high-level stuff is important, but then those of us who are faculty members
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
schools of public health and other places, just walk across the street if you got a College of Education and just begin to ask, can I come and speak to your teacher educators? Because if we approach it from that level, we have a high-level approach, but then we have the building...
The practice, at the practice level, yes.
And it works in that context.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I know that came after, so I'm just going to ask you to sort of...
I just have two questions. My first question was for Principal McGee, and just in terms of addressing your issue in terms of the graduation rate and dropout rate, did you institute a particular high school reform effort? And then for Mr. Allen, I just wanted to know, how is the St. John's Health Center funded in terms of being a special, I mean, in terms of being a school-based health center?
Can you come to the mic? I'm sorry. I think that's a question that several people will want to hear, and I'm sorry it's so inconvenient. I really am, but they didn't put one at the desk. I apologize, but I want to make sure everybody hears it.
Central is under the premise of being reconstituted. It was labeled as a PLA school, persistently low-achieving school. So with that, under No Child Left Behind, that you have to integrate educational entities into the school. So we have educational partnerships that we brought into the school in conjunction with the partnerships that we've developed with the Educational Consortium and Michigan Department of Education, as well as General Motors. So it's been a holistic approach. From the 45-member consortium, we're dwindling it down to the 18 major partners that pretty much committed themselves to, from a survey standpoint, to look at the needs of the students as well as the entire community. The multilinear approach in terms of the graduation rate, inclusion, full inclusion under the EAA, we have the student-centered learning model, okay? The students are at the center of all learning. That we moved from a traditional to a non-traditional method, that we don't have grade levels, that we have instructional levels. So based on a performance series, exam, students, whatever instructional level that they test at, generally isn't at the appropriate grade level. So they begin to receive their work individually at that particular level. We're fortunate that we have probably more netbooks and laptops in our school than we have students. Okay, so literally they have an opportunity to follow their own individual pathways based on those instructional levels. And we were fortunate in moving and increasing instructional levels and moving them to what we call decile levels, where you're moving one or more grade levels within a semester. Because, you know, the level of frustration of not being able to function at the grade level is alleviated because you're at your instructional level. But you're pressed by the leadership in the building, the teacher, as well as your parents, to move at a haste pace in order to get to that instructional level. And then for those students who are at level and beyond, they can participate in instructional levels at honors level or AP, or that of going off into more advanced college courses. Yeah.
And wait, there was another question about St. John.
Yeah, you wanted to know about our funding source. We're funded through the Michigan Department of Community Health. We are in the fourth year of a five-year grant. And kind of going back to the cost of a school-based health center is extremely expensive, and we have to get buy-in from the principals. And it plays a major role. Right now, St. John's has about 15 school-based health centers in the Michigan Southeast area. We're doing great work.
And Michigan has a sizable commitment as a state to school-based health care. I think there's almost 100 centers in the state of Michigan. Yes, ma'am.
Their bodies to be more predisposed to high level because of high cholesterol.
Okay.
So even there is a leakage between food they eat and really unwanted pregnancy outcome. So really, in terms of education-wise, really we need to bring all advanced and the intersectoral or interdisciplinary
I'm sorry, we need to get to your question because you have a lot more people behind you and we're running out of time. So what's the question?
I have the question.
Okay, very
okay.
good.
So literally, we took a multilinear approach to that also. At one time, we had a Subway restaurant in our building where our students worked in the Subway restaurant. That was our entire cafeteria. We had 30 students that were working. That direct connection with Subway in terms of portions, and nutrition and calories, okay? But in addition to that, we have a parent empowerment zone in our school that's open from 7:30 in the morning until 6 o'clock in the evening, where parents, any caregiver, can come to the school, and we invite them to the school, but we also have professional developments that deal with testing, professional developments on health and good eating habits. So they're coming to the school for the professional development. We invite them in. We give foods. We have giveaways, and we have incentives. But when they come, we are able to impart the important information that they need and able to, and they go back to their families with them or go back to the communities. The other things that we do within the consortium is that we have invited the appropriate partners to the table. Mind you, I said we had 45. Everybody wants to be associated with the school because they can get grant money. Well, we dwindled that 45 down to the primary 18 that have action steps behind their own philosophy and pedagogy that they're going to assist in the process of assisting students as well as their parents and giving and imparting the appropriate knowledge about good health, nutrition, citizenry, a litany of things that's based on the partnership. So that's the way that we've looked at it.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
As far as our sustainability, we got required, we have mandates by the Michigan Department of Community Health to reach after our five-year grant. And after our five-year grant is up, they will evaluate not only our agency as well as other agencies who's applying for specific grants. Typically, we get our grants because we have a good relationship with the Michigan Department of Community Health. As far as linking out to the community, my supervisor, who's not here because of a leg injury, he goes out and gets grants, talks to a lot of people in the public sector to get money to not only assist us with our health center, but also to look at resources in the community as well to assist our students.
Okay. So, in addition, reimbursement. Although it will never pay 100%. So it has to be a mixture of revenue sources. But for example, school-based health centers were recognized in the Child Health Insurance Program that President Obama signed shortly after he was inaugurated. School-based health centers are recognized in the Affordable Care Act, and there were resources made available for expansion. In some states, depending on the type of resources, they reimburse through Medicaid as well, depending on Medicaid policy. So the initiative that I referred to earlier on was exactly that initiative, was to expand policy to incorporate school-based health centers so they could begin to access some of those traditional mechanisms for financing and not be 100% dependent on grants, whether it be from philanthropy or government. But there will always be some portion. When you look at the revenue pie, there will always be some portion that has to come from philanthropy, government, reimbursement, local community opportunities, and in some cases even education resources to the extent that they're available. But there is no one model of financing to sustain it at 100%. And I would bet that if Ken was here, he would talk about how much of that cost they eat. You know, as a nonprofit health system, they probably have a portion of that they're also subsidizing. It's the elephant in the room all the time. All the time. Yes, ma'am. That's a fundamental model, primary care and mental health. They go hand in hand, so that's really fundamental, yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
If, you know, as you could say all of the things, but if it's not,
yeah.
How does it impact at least to that graduation rate? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Anyone, my name would not be affiliated with the center if we weren't evaluating. Absolutely not. I'm a staunch believer in it. I believe it's important to document what's happening, what's not happening, and put it out there. So if you go to our website, you'll see several evaluation reports from previous bodies of work that we've participated in. I'm absolutely, because that's although it's very interesting, is that when you look at community pediatrics, it's not evaluated in the same way. However, we know better, so we're going to do better. And absolutely, as a safety net provider, we must commit to that. So I'm on board. We're in the choir on that. Yes, ma'am. One more, I think, because we're at 12 o'clock, I believe. Yeah. Right.
We haven't been successful in partnering with school-based health centers right now, so we're both basically going in with mobile equipment and using any space that's available. What we have found is that the schools, once they integrate the oral health services in kind of a smaller, forgive the pun, bite-size approach, they are then feeling prepared to come back to the school-based health center idea that they can get their heads around this, they can, the community gets it, the staff understand that it's not a burden that they were afraid of, that it's actually an asset. Children are better able to learn, their nutrition needs are met better, they're also, the social engagement, if their kids are healthy, they're smiling.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not healthy, they're able to get referred to care. We found that about 75% of our schools, the children that we're treating can actually be cared for entirely at the school, not referred out.
A what?
Two new schools. We feel like we're working with our Delta students to help them and hygiene students to get them their head around community-based care and be excited about it, but it's invigorating, robust work. It's not sitting in an office where you're trying to see the same thing over and over again, that the complexities are exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely, absolutely, definitely. Thank you for the reminder, but we absolutely do, for sure. There was one more. John, yes, I knew there was one more, and that will be it. I'm sorry. And I invite you again to take materials before you leave. John.
The question I have is this. The LGBT kids face much extraordinarily higher level of risk.
Right.
All of those YRBSS categories, the juvenile justice interactions, and then the African-American boys who are gay,
right,
sexual, their HIV incidence off the charts. So my question is, you know, what kinds of mechanisms or methods do you have to help those kids find the space they need to deal with those issues?
Okay, so I'm going to answer the first part, and then I'm going to turn it. First thing is to ask, and RAPS includes a question about sexual orientation in a way, again, that's safe for them to identify. So once you have that, then kicks in what happens after that. So
once those students are identified, we will kind of collect them, you know, confidentiality, bring them down for group meetings. I also go into class and do classroom education on that particular topic, bullying, how that affects, you know, that population. So we provide the kids with education. We just also identify their needs as well. So I'm doing individual therapy as well as group counseling with those students, and it's been effective.
Literally, my staff is probably more close to like 70% male. Okay, that's by design. When I say that, we educate all children, but like I said before, 100% of my children have a mother. And over 98% of them do not have a father. This program that we have, the Young Men of Excellence program, which I started as a coach, as a teacher, and many of them, it's been over 1,300 of them, many of them now have graduated from college. Some are doctors and lawyers, some are teachers. So I have several of them now that are gen ed teachers and special ed teachers, and they have a direct focus on all students, but a more direct focus on the males within the building. So we have gender-specific classes, the Young Men of Excellence Academy, which is on our third floor, literally they can discuss issues, be the health issue, sexual orientation and things of that nature, that they have someone that they're comfortable to come to and talk to. From a medical standpoint, they can be referred to St. John's Hospital. The early childhood program that we're opening up in January is for 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old males, 16 in each classroom. So literally you're going to start in much earlier, opening those avenues of communication and opportunity for children. Yeah.
Thank you all for being here, and let's thank our panelists one more time.